silver halls in Valmar abode long empty, for he came no nearer to them for a great while than the shadow's edge, whither came the wailing of his sea-birds far away. Now the Solosimpi abode not much in Kor, but had strange dwellings among the shoreland rocks, and Ulmo came and sat among them as aforetime in Tolaresia, and that was his time of greatest mirth and gentleness, and all his lore and love of music he poured out to them, and they drank it eagerly. Musics did they make and weave, catching threads of sound whispered by waters in caverns, or by wave-tops brushed by gentle winds, and these they twined with the wail of gulls and the echoes of their own sweet voices in the places of their home. But the Teleri and Inwir gathered harvest of poesy and song, and were oftenest among the gods, dancing in the skyey halls of Manwë, for the joy of Varda of the stars, or filling the streets and courts of Valmar with the strange loveliness of their pomps and revelry. For Orome and for Nessa they danced upon green swards, and the glades of Valinor knew them, as they flitted among the gold-lit trees, and Palurian was very merry for the sight of them. Often were the Noldoli with them, and made much music, for the multitude of their harps and viols was very sweet, and Salmar loved them. But their greatest delight was in the courts of Aule, or in their own dear homes in Kor, fashioning many beautiful things, and weaving many stories. With paintings and broidered hangings, and carvings of great delicacy they filled all their city, and even did Valmar grow more fair beneath their skilful hands. Now is to tell how the Solosimpi fared often about the near seas in their swan ships, or drawn by the birds, or paddling themselves with great oars that they had made to the likeness of the webs of swan or duck. And they dredged the seabeds, and won wealth of the slim shells of those magic waters, and uncounted store of pearls of a most pure and starry luster. And these were both their glory and delight, and the envy of the other Eldar, who longed for them to shine in the adornment of the city of Kor. But those of the Noldoli whom Aule had most deeply taught labored in secret unceasingly, and of Aule they had wealth of metals, and of stones and marbles, and of the leave of the Valar much store too was granted to them of the radiance of Colulin and of Telimpe held in hidden bowls. Starlight they had of Varda, and strands of the bluest Ilwe Manwë gave them, water of the most limpid pools in that creek of Kor, and crystal drops from all the sparkling founts in the courts of Valmar. Dews did they gather in the woods of Orome, and flower petals of all hues and honeys in Yavanna's gardens, and they chased the beams of Laurelin and Silpion amongst the leaves. But when all this wealth of fair and radiant things was gathered, they got at the Solosimpi many shells, white and pink, and purest foam, and lastly, some few pearls. These pearls were their model, and the lore of Aule and the magic of the Valar were their tools, and all the most lovely things of the substance of the earth, the matters of their craft, and therefrom did the Noldoli with great labor invent and fashion the first gems. Crystals did they make of the waters of the springs, shot with the lights of Silpion. Amber and chrysoprase and topaz glowed beneath their hands, and garnets and rubies they wrought, making their glassy substance, as Aule had taught them, but dyeing them with the juices of roses and red flowers, and to each they gave a heart of fire. Emeralds some made of the water of the creek of Kor, and glints among the grassy glades of Valinor, and sapphires did they fashion in great profusion, tinging them with the airs of Manwë. Amethysts there were, and moonstones, beryls and onyx, agates of blended marbles and many lesser stones, and their hearts were very glad, nor were they content with a few, but made them jewels in immeasurable number, till all the fair substances were well nigh exhausted, and the great piles of those gems might not be concealed, but blazed in the light like beds of brilliant flowers. Then took they those pearls that had, and some of well nigh all their jewels, and made a new gem of a milky pallor, shot with gleams like echoes of all other stones, and this they thought very fair, and they were opals. But still some labored on, and of starlight and the purest water drops, of the dew of Silpion and the thinnest air, they made diamonds, and challenged any to make fairer. Then arose Feanor of the Noldoli, and fared to the Solus Impi and begged a great pearl, and he got moreover an urn full of the most luminous phosphor light, gathered of foam in dark places, and with these he came home, and he took all the other gems, and did gather their glint by the light of white lamps and silver candles, and he took the sheen of pearls, and the faint half-colours of opals, and he bathed them in phosphorescence, and the radiant dew of Silpion, and but a single tiny drop of the light of Laurelin did he let fall therein, and giving all those magic lights a body to dwell in of such perfect glass as he alone could make, nor even Aule compass, so great was the slender dexterity of the fingers of Feanor, he made a jewel, and it shone of its own wizardous, note 10, radiance in the uttermost dark. And he set it therein, and sat a very long while, and gazed at its beauty. Then he made two more, and had no more stuffs, and he fetched the others to behold his handiwork, and they were utterly amazed, and those jewels he called Silmarilli, or, as we say the name in the speech of the Noldoli today, Silubrilthin, note 11. Wherefore, though the Solus Impi held ever that none of the gems of the Noldoli, not even that majestic shimmer of diamonds, overpassed their tender pearls, yet have all held, whoever saw them, that the Silmarils of Feanor were the most beautiful jewels that ever shone or glowed. Now Kor is lit with this wealth of gems, and sparkles most marvellously, and all the kindred of the Eldalie are made rich in their loveliness by the generosity of the Noldoli, and the god's desire of their beauty is sated to the full. Sapphires in great wonder were given to Manwë, and his raiment was crusted with them, and Orome had a belt of emeralds, but Yavanna loved all the gems, and Aule's delight was in diamonds and amethysts. Melko alone was given none of them, for that he had not expiated his many crimes, and he lusted after them exceedingly, yet said naught, feigning to hold them of lesser worth than metals. But now all the kindred of the Eldalie has found its greatest bliss, and the majesty and glory of the gods, and their home is augmented to the greatest splendour that the world has seen, and the trees shone on Valinor, and Valinor gave back their light in a thousand scintillations of splintered colours. But the great lands were still and dark and very lonesome, and Ossë sat without the precincts, and saw the moon gleam of Silpion twinkle on the pebbles of diamonds and of crystals, which the gnomes cast in prodigality about the margin of the seas, and the glassy fragments, splintered in their labouring, glittered about the seaward face of Kor. But the pools amid the dark rocks were filled with jewels, and the Solus Impi, whose robes were sewn with pearls, danced about them. And that was the fairest of all shores, and the music of the waters about those silver strands was beyond all sounds enchanting. These were the rocks of Eldamar, and I saw them long ago, for Inwë was my grandsire's sire, note 12, and even he was the eldest of the elves, and had lived yet in majesty, had he not perished in that march into the world. But Ingil, his son, went long ago back to Valinor, and is with Manwë. And I am also akin to the shoreland dancers, and these things that I tell you, I know they are true. And the magic and the wonder of the Bay of Faerie is such that none who have seen it, as it was then, can speak without a catch of the breath and a sinking of the voice. Then Meryl the Queen ceased her long tale, but Eriol said naught, gazing at the long radiance of the westering sun, gleaming through the apple boles, and dreaming of Faerie. At length said Meryl, "Fare now home, for the afternoon has waned, and the telling of the tale has set a weight of desire in my heart and in thine. But be in patience, and bide yet ere ye seek fellowship with that sad kindred of the island elves." But Ariel said, "Even now I know not, and it passes my heart to guess, how all that loveliness came to fading, or the elves might be prevailed to depart from Eldamar." But Meryl said, "Nay, I have lengthened the tale too much for love of those days, and many great things lie between the making of the gems and the coming back to Tolaresia. But these things many know as well as I, and Lindo or Rumil of Marvanwachelyeva would tell them more skillfully than I. Then did she and Ariel fare back to the House of Flowers, and Ariel took his leave ere the western face of Ingil's tower was yet grown grey with dusk. Notes. 1. The manuscript has Vire, but this can only be a slip. 2. The occurrence of the name Telimpe here and again later in the tale, as also in that of the Sun and Moon, is curious. In the tale of the coming of the Valar and the building of Valinor, the name was changed at its first appearance from Telimpe, Cylindrin in parenthesis, to Cylindrin, and at subsequent occurrences, Cylindrin was written from the first. The Coming of the Valar, side 3. 3. The manuscript has Linwe here and again below, see under Tinwe Linto, in changes made to names at the end of these notes. 4. This sentence from And Beguiled was added after, though not to all appearance much after, the writing of the text. 5. This sentence from And One Elu was added at the same time as that referred to in note 4. 6. The first occurrence of the form Winen, and so written at the time of composition, i.e. not corrected, from Onan. 7. Arvalin, thus written at the time of composition, not emended from Habanan or Harmalin as previously. 8. When my father wrote these texts, he wrote first in pencil and then subsequently wrote over the top of it in ink, erasing the penciled text, of which bits can be read here and there, and from which one can see that he altered the penciled original somewhat as he went along. At the words, glistened wondrously, however, he abandoned the writing of the new text in ink, and from this point we have only the original penciled manuscript, which is in places exceedingly difficult to read, being more hasty, and also soft and smudged in the course of time. In deciphering this text, I have been in places defeated, and I use brackets and question marks to indicate uncertain readings, and rows of dots to show roughly the length of illegible words. It is to be emphasized, therefore, that from here on there is only a first draft, and one written very rapidly, dashed onto the page. 9. Arvalin, here and subsequently emended from Habanan, see note 7. The explanation is clearly that the name Arvalin came in at or before the time of the rewriting in ink over the penciled text, though further on in the narrative we are here at an earlier stage of composition. 10. The word might be read as Wizardus. 11. Other forms, beginning S-I-G-M, preceded Silubrothin, which cannot be read with certainty. Merrill speaks as if the gnomish name was the form used in Tolaresia, but it is not clear why. 12. My grandsire's sire, the original reading was my grandsire. Changes made to names in the coming of the elves and the making of Kor. Tinwe Linto, capital T-I-N-W-E, capital L-I-N-T-O, changed from Linwe Tinto, capital L-I-N-W-E, capital T-I-N-T-O. This latter is the form of the name in an interpolated passage in the preceding tale, see The Chaining of Melko, side 4, note 1. At two subsequent occurrences of Linwe, see note 3 above, the name was not changed, clearly through oversight. In the two added passages where the name occurs, see notes 4 and 5 above, the form is Tinwe with Linto in brackets. In Withiel, changed from Gimgithil, the same change in the Cottage of Lost Play, side 1. Tinwelint, capital T-I-N-W-E-L-I-N-T, changed from Tintoglin, capital T-I-N-T-O-G-L-I-N. Wendelin, capital W-E-N-D-E-L-I-N, changed from Tindriel, capital T-I-N-D-R-I-E-L. Compare the interpolated passage in the previous tale, The Chaining of Melko, side 4, note 1. Arvalin, changed from Habanen, throughout the tale except once, where the name was written Arvalin from the first, see notes 7 and 9 above. Lindaloxe, changed from Lindalote, the same change in The Coming of the Valar and the Building of Valinor, see side 3. Erumani, changed from Harwalin. Commentary on The Coming of the Elves and the Making of Kor. I have already touched, in The Chaining of Melchoside 4, on the great difference in the structure of the narrative at the beginning of this tale, namely that here the elves awoke during Melko's captivity in Valinor, whereas in the later story it was the very fact of the awakening that brought the Valar to make war on Melkor, which led to his imprisonment in Mandos. Thus the ultimately very important matter of the capture of the elves about Quivienen by Melkor, the Silmarillion, pages 49 to 50, is necessarily entirely absent. The release of Melko from Mandos here takes place far earlier, before the coming of the elvish ambassadors to Valinor, and Melko plays a part in the debate concerning the summons. The story of Orome's coming upon the newly awakened elves is seen to go back to the beginnings, though here Yavanna Palurian was also present, as it appears, but its singular beauty and force is the less for the fact of their coming being known independently to Manwë, so that the great Valar did not need to be told of it by Orome. The name Eldar was already in existence in Valinor before the awakening, and the story of its being given by Orome, the people of the stars, had not arisen, as will be seen from the appendix on names. Eldar had a quite different etymology at this time. The later distinction between the Eldar, who followed Orome on the westward journey to the ocean, and the Avari, the unwilling, who would not heed the summons of the Valar, is not present, and indeed in this tale there is no suggestion that any elves who heard the summons refused it. There were, however, according to another later tale, elves who never left Palisor. Gilfanan's tale, The Travail of the Noldoli, sides 8 and 9. Here it is Nornore, herald of the gods, not Orome, who brought the three elves to Valinor, and afterwards returned them to the waters of awakening. And it is notable that even in this earliest version, given more than the later to explanations, there is no hint of how they passed from the distant parts of the earth to Valinor, when afterwards the great march was only achieved with such difficulty. The story of the questioning of the three elves by Manwë concerning the nature of their coming into the world and their loss of all memory of what preceded their awakening did not survive the lost tales. A further important shift in the structure is seen in Ulmo's eager support of the party favoring the summoning of the elves to Valinor. In The Silmarillion, page 52, Ulmo was the chief of those who held that the Quendi should be left free to walk as they would in Middle-earth. I set out here the early history of the names of the chief Eldar. Elu Thingol, Quenya Elwë Thingolo, began as Linwë Tinto, also simply Linwë. This was changed to Tinwë Linto, Tinwë. His gnomish name was at first Tintoglin, then Tinwëlint. He was the leader of the Sulasimpi, the later Teleri, on the Great Journey, but he was beguiled in his Ilome by the Fae Tindriel, changed to Wendelin, later Melian, who came from the gardens of Lorien in Valinor. He became lord of the elves of his Ilome, and their daughter was Tinuviel. The leader of the Sulasimpi in his place was, confusingly, Ellu, afterwards Olwë, brother of Elwë. The lord of the Noldoli was Finwë Nolome, also Nolome Finwë, and most commonly simply Nolome. The name Finwë remained throughout the history. In the gnomish speech, he was Golfinweg. His son was Turondo, in gnomish, Turgon. Later Turgon became Finwë's grandson, being the son of Finwë's son, Fingolfin. The lord of the Teleri, afterwards the Vanyar, was Ing, changed to Inwë, here called Isil Inwë, named in gnomish Gimgithil, changed to Enwithil. His son, who built the great tower of Cortirion, was Ingilmo, changed to Ingil. The royal clan of the Teleri were the Inwir. Thus, lost tales, later forms of names, Isil Inwë, gnomish Enwithil, lord of the Teleri. His son, Ingil. The Silmarillion, Ingwë, lord of the Vanyar. Lost tales, Finwë Nolome, gnomish Golfinweg, lord of the Noldoli. His son, Turondo, gnomish Turgon. The Silmarillion, Finwë, lord of the Noldor. His grandson, Turgon. Lost tales, Tinwe Linto, gnomish Tinwe Lint, Lord of the Solar Simpi, later Lord of the Elves of Hisilome, the Silmarillion, Elwe Singolo, Sindarin Eluthingol, Lord of the Teleri, later Lord of the Grey Elves of Beleriand. Lost Tales, Wendelin, their daughter Tinuviel, the Silmarillion, Melian, their daughter Luthien Tinuviel. Lost Tales, Elu, Lord of the Solar Simpi, after the loss of Tinwe Linto, the Silmarillion, Olwe, Lord of the Teleri, after the loss of his brother, Elwe Singollo. In the Silmarillion, page 48, is described the second star-making of Varda before and in preparation for the coming of the elves. Then Varda went forth from the council, and she looked out from the height of Taniquetil, and beheld the darkness of Middle-earth beneath the innumerable stars, faint and far. Then she began a great labor, greatest of all the works of the Valar since their coming into Arda. She took the silver dews from the vats of Telperion, and therewith she made new stars and brighter against the coming of the firstborn. In the earliest version, we see the conception already present that the stars were created in two separate acts, that a new star-making by Varda celebrated the coming of the elves, even though here the elves were already awakened, and that the new stars were derived from the liquid light fallen from the moon tree Silpion. The passage just cited from the Silmarillion goes on to tell that it was at the time of the second star-making that Varda, high in the north, as a challenge to Melkor, set the crown of seven mighty stars to swing, Valakirka, the sickle of the Valar and sign of doom. But here this is denied, and a special origin is claimed for the Great Bear, whose stars were not of Varda's contriving, but were sparks that escaped from Aule's forge. In the little notebook mentioned in the Cottage of Lost Play, side one, which is full of disjointed jottings and hastily noted projects, a different form of this myth appears. The silver sickle, the seven butterflies. Aule was making a silver sickle. Melkor interrupted his work, telling him a lie concerning the Lady Palurian. Aule so wroth that he broke the sickle with a blow. Seven sparks leapt up and winged into the heavens. Varda caught them and gave them a place in the heavens as a sign of Palurian's honor. They fly now ever in the shape of a sickle, round and round the pole. There can be no doubt, I think, that this note is earlier than the present text. The star, Morwinion, who blazes above the world's edge in the west, is Arcturus, see the appendix on names. It is nowhere explained why Morwinion Arcturus is mythically conceived to be always in the west. Turning now to the Great March and the crossing of the ocean, the origin of Tolaresia in the island on which Ase drew the gods to the western lands at the time of the fall of the lamps, see the coming of the Valar, side 3, was necessarily lost afterwards with the loss of that story, and Ase ceased to have any proprietary right upon it. The idea that the Eldar came to the shores of the great lands in three large and separated companies, in the order Teleri, Noldori, Solosimpi, as later Vanyar, Noldor, Teleri, goes back to the beginning. But here the first people and the second people each crossed the ocean alone, whereas afterwards they crossed together. In the Silmarillion, page 58, many years elapsed before Ulmo returned for the last of the three kindreds, the Teleri, so long a time that they came to love the coasts of Middle-earth, and Ase was able to persuade some of them to remain, Círdan, the shipwright, and the elves of the Falas, with their havens at Brithomba and Eglarest. Of this there is no trace in the earliest account, though the germ of the idea of the long wait of the last comers for Ulmo's return is present. In the published version, the cause of Ase's rage against the transportation of the Eldar on the floating island has disappeared, and his motive for anchoring the island in the ocean is wholly different. Indeed, he did this at the bidding of Ulmo, the Silmarillion, page 59, who was opposed to the summoning of the Eldar to Valinor in any case. But the anchoring of Tolaresia as a rebellious act of Ase's long remained an element in the story. It is not made clear what other scattered islands of his domain Ase anchored to the sea bottom, But since on the drawing of the world ship, the Lonely Isle, the Magic Isles, and the Twilight Isles are all shown in the same way, as standing like pinnacles from the weedy depths, see The Coming of the Valar, side 3, it was probably these that Ossé now established, though Rumil and Meryl still speak of the Twilight Isles, as floating on the shadowy seas. The Coming of the Valar, side 3. In the old story, it is made very clear that Tolaresia was made fast, far out in the mid-ocean, and no land may be seen for many leagues sail from its cliffs. That was indeed the reason for its name, which was diminished when the Lonely Isle came to be set in the Bay of Eldamar. But the words used of Tolaresia, the Lonely Isle that looks both west and east, in the last chapter of the Silmarillion, relatively very little worked on and revised, undoubtedly derive from the old story. In the tale of Aeltwine of England is seen the origin of this phrase, the lonely island looking east to the magic archipelago and to the lands of men beyond it, and west into the shadows beyond which afar off is glimpsed the outer land, the kingdom of the gods. The deep sundering of the speech of the Solos Impi from that of the other kindreds, referred to in this tale, is preserved in the Silmarillion, but the idea arose in the days when Tolaresia was far further removed from Valinor. As is very often to be observed in the evolution of these myths, an early idea survived in a wholly altered context. Here, the growth of trees and plants on the westward slopes of the floating island began with its twice lying in the Bay of Faery and catching the light of the trees when the Teleri and Noldali disembarked. And its greater beauty and fertility remained from those times after it was anchored far away from Valinor in the midst of the ocean. Afterwards, this idea survived in the context of the light of the trees passing through the Kalakiria and falling on Tolaresia near at hand in the Bay of Eldamar. Similarly, it seems that Ulmo's instruction of the Solos Impi in music and sea lore while sitting upon a headland of Tolaresia after its binding to the sea bottom was shifted to Ossé's instruction of the Teleri in all manner of sea lore and sea music, sitting on a rock off the coast of Middle-earth. The Silmarillion, page 58. Very noteworthy is the account given here of the gap in the mountains of Valinor. In the Silmarillion, the Valar made this gap, the Kalakiria or Pass of Light, only after the coming of the Eldar to Aman, for even among the radiant flowers of the tree-lit gardens of Valinor, they, the Vanyar and Noldor, longed still at times to see the stars, page 59, whereas in this tale it was a natural feature, associated with a long creek thrust in from the sea. From the account of the coming of the elves to the shores of the great lands, it is seen that Hisilome was a region bordering the great sea, agreeing with its identification as the region marked G on the earliest map, see The Coming of the Valar, side 3, The Chaining of Melko, side 4, and most remarkably we meet here the idea that men were shut in Hisilome by Melko, an idea that survived right through to the final form, in which the Easterling men were rewarded after the Nirnaeth Arnoediad for their treacherous service to Morgoth by being confined in Hithlum, the Silmarillion, page 195. In the description of the hill and city of Kor appear several features that were never lost in the later accounts of Tirion upon Tuna. Compare the Silmarillion, page 59. Upon the crown of Tuna, the city of the elves was built, the white walls and terraces of Tirion, and the highest of the towers of that city was the tower of Ingwe, Mindon Eldalieva, whose silver lamp shone far out into the mists of the sea. The dust of gold and magic metals that Aule piled about the feet of Kor powdered the shoes and clothing of Eärendil when he climbed the long white stairs of Tirion. The Silmarillion, page 248. It is not said here whether the shoots of Laurelin and Silpion that the gods gave to Inwe and Nolame, which blossomed both eternally without abating, were also givers of light, but later in the Lost Tales, The Hiding of Valinor, side 8, after the flight of the Noldali, The trees of Kor are again referred to, and there the trees given to Inwe shone still, while the trees given to Nolame had been uprooted and were gone, no one knew whither. In the Silmarillion it is said that Yavanna made for the Vanyar and the Noldor a tree like to a lesser image of Talperion, save that it did not give light of its own being. It was planted in the courts beneath the Mindon, and there flourished, and its seedlings were many in Eldamar. Thence came the tree of Tolaresia. In connection with this description of the city of the elves in Valinor, I give here a poem entitled Kor. It was written on April the 30th, 1915, 2 days after Goblin Feet and You and Me. See The Cottage of Lost Play, Side 2, and 2 texts of it are extant. The first, in manuscript, has a subtitle, In a City Lost and Dead. The second, a typescript, was apparently first entitled Kor, but this was changed to The City of the Gods, and the subtitle erased, and with this title the poem was published at Leeds in 1923. Footnote, publication was in a magazine called The Microcosm, edited by Dorothy Ratcliffe, Volume 8, Number 1, Spring 1923, end of footnote. No changes were made to the text except that in the penultimate line, No bird sings was altered already in the manuscript to No voice stirs. It seems possible, especially in view of the original subtitle, that the poem described Kor after the elves had left it. Kor, in a city lost and dead. A sable hill, gigantic, rampart-crowned, stands gazing out across an azure sea under an azure sky, on whose dark ground, impearled as gainst a floor of porphyry, gleam marble temples white and dazzling halls, and tawny shadows, fingered long, are made in fretted bars upon their ivory walls by massy trees, rock-rooted in the shade, like stony chiselled pillars of the vault with shaft and capital of black basalt. Their slow forgotten days for ever reap the silent shadows, counting out rich hours, and no voice stirs, and all the marble towers, white, hot, and soundless, ever burn and sleep. The story of the evolution of seabirds by Ossi and of how the Solosimpi went at last to Valinor in ships of swan shape drawn by gulls, to the chagrin of Ossi, is greatly at variance with the account in the Silmarillion, page 61. Through a long age they, the Teleri, dwelt in Tolaresia, but slowly their hearts were changed, and were drawn towards the light that flowed out over the sea to the lonely isle. They were torn between the love of the music of the waves upon their shores, and the desire to see again their kindred, and to look upon the splendour of Valinor. But in the end, desire of the light was the stronger. Therefore Ulmo, submitting to the will of the Valar, sent to them Ossi, their friend, and he, though grieving, taught them the craft of shipbuilding. And when their ships were built, he brought them as his parting gift many strong-winged swans. Then the swans drew the white ships of the Teleri over the windless sea, and thus at last and latest they came to Aman and the shores of Eldamar. But the swans remained as a gift of Ossi to the elves of Tolaresia, and the ships of the Teleri retained the form of the ships built by Aule for the Solosimpi. They were made in the likeness of swans, with beaks of gold and eyes of gold and jet, the Silmarillion. The passage of geographical description that follows is curious, for it is extremely similar to, and even in some phrases identical with, that in the tale of the coming of the Valar and the building of Valinor, side 3. An explanation of this repetition is suggested below. This second version gives, in fact, little new information, its chief difference of substance being the mention of Tolaresia. It is now made clear that the shadowy seas were a region of the great sea west of Tolaresia. In the Silmarillion, page 102, the conception had changed with the change in the anchorage of Tolaresia. At the time of the hiding of Valinor, the enchanted isles were set, and all the seas about them were filled with shadows and bewilderment, and these isles were strung as a net in the shadowy seas, from the north to the south, before Tol Eressia, the lonely isle, is reached by one sailing west. There is a further element of repetition in the account of the gap in the mountains of Valinor and the hill of Kor at the head of the creek, which have already been described earlier in this same tale. The explanation of this repetition is almost certainly to be found in the two layers of composition in this tale, see note 8 above, for the first of these passages is in the revised portion, and the second in the original penciled text. My father, in his revision, had, I think, simply taken in earlier the passage concerning the gap in the mountains, the hill, and the creek, and if he had continued the revision of the tale to its end, the second passage would have been excised. This explanation may be suggested also for the repetition of the passage concerning the islands in the Great Sea and the coast of Valinor from the tale of the coming of the Valar and the building of Valinor, but in that case the implication must be that the revision in ink over the original penciled manuscript was carried out when the latter was already far ahead in the narrative. In the Silmarillion, the entire account of the making of gem stones by the Noldali has become compressed into these words, page 60. And it came to pass that the masons of the house of Finwë, quarrying in the hills after stone, for they delighted in the building of high towers, first discovered the earth gems, and brought them forth in countless myriads. And they devised tools for the cutting and shaping of gems, and carved them in many forms. They hoarded them not, but gave them freely, and by their labor enriched all Valinor. Thus the rhapsodic account at the end of this tale of the making of gems out of magic materials, starlight and Ilwë, dews and petals, glassy substances dyed with the juice of flowers, was abandoned, and the Noldor became miners, skilful indeed, but mining only what was there to be found in the rocks of Valinor. On the other hand, in an earlier passage in the Silmarillion, page 39, the old idea is retained. The Noldor also it was who first achieved the making of gems. It need not be said that everything was to be gained by the discretion of the later writing. In this early narrative, the Silmarils are not strongly marked out from the accumulated wonder of all the rest of the gems of the Noldali's making. Features that remained are the generosity of the Noldor in the giving of their gems and the scattering of them on the shores, compare the Silmarillion, page 61, many jewels the Noldor gave them, the Teleri, opals and diamonds and pale crystals, which they strewed upon the shores and scattered in the pools, the pearls that the Teleri got from the sea, the Silmarillion, the sapphires that the Noldor gave to Manwë, his scepter was of sapphire, which the Noldor wrought for him, the Silmarillion, page 40, and of course Fëanor as the maker of the Silmarils, although, as will be seen in the next tale, Fëanor was not yet the son of Finwë, Nolimë. I conclude this commentary with another early poem that bears upon the matter of this tale. It is said in the tale that men in Hissilome feared the lost elves, calling them the Shadow Folk, and that their name for the land was Ariador. The meaning of this is given in the early Gnomish word list as land or place of shadow, compare the meanings of Hissilome and Dor Lomin, the chaining of Melko, side 4. The poem is called A Song of Ariador and is extant in two copies. According to notes on these, it was written in an army camp near Lichfield on September the 12th, 1915. It was never, to my knowledge, printed. The first copy in manuscript has the title also in Old English, An Leoth Eargedores. The second, in typescript, has virtually no differences in the text, but it may be noted that the first word of the third verse, she, is an emendation from he in both copies. A Song of Ariador. In the vales of Ariador, by the wooded inland shore, green the lakeward bents and meads, sloping down to murmurous reeds that whisper in the dusk o'er Ariador. Do you hear the many bells of the goats upon the fells, where the valley tumbles downward from the pines? Do you hear the blue woods moan when the sun has gone alone to hunt the mountain shadows in the pines? She is lost among the hills, and the upland slowly fills with the shadow folk that murmur in the fern. And still there are the bells and the voices on the fells, while eastward a few stars begin to burn. Men are kindling tiny gleams far below by mountain streams, where they dwell among the beech woods near the shore, but the great woods on the height watch the waning western light and whisper to the wind of things of yore. When the valley was unknown and the waters roared alone and the shadow folk danced downward all the night, when the sun had fared abroad through great forests unexplored and the woods were full of wandering beams of light, then were voices on the fells and a sound of ghostly bells and a march of shadow people o'er the height. In the mountains by the shore, in forgotten Ariador, there was dancing and was ringing, there were shadow people singing ancient songs of olden gods in Ariador. 6. The Theft of Melko and the Darkening of Valinor. Introduction. This title is again taken from the cover of the book containing the text. The narrative, still written rapidly in pencil, see note 8 to the last chapter, with some emendations from the same time or later, continues without a break. The Theft of Melko and the Darkening of Valinor. Now came Ariel home to the cottage of Lost Play, and his love for all the things that he saw about him, and his desire to understand them all, became more deep. Continually did he thirst to know yet more of the history of the Eldar, nor did he ever fail to be among those who fared each evening to the room of the tale-fire. And so, on a time when he had already sojourned some while as a guest of Vairi and Lindo, it so passed that Lindo, at his entreaty, spake thus from his deep chair. Listen then, O Ariel, if thou wouldst know how it so came that the loveliness of Valinor was abated, or the elves might ever be constrained to leave the shores of Eldamar. It may well be that you know already that Melko dwelt in Valmar as a servant in the house of Tulkas in those days of the joy of the Eldalye. There did he nurse his hatred of the gods and his consuming jealousy of the Eldar, but it was his lust for the beauty of the gems, for all his feigned indifference, that in the end overbore his patience and caused him to design deep and evilly. Now the Noldoli alone at those times had the art of fashioning these beautiful things, and despite their rich gifts to all whom they loved, the treasure they possessed of them was beyond count the greatest. Wherefore Melko, whenever he may, consorteth with them, speaking cunning words. In this way, for long he sought to beg gifts of jewels for himself, and maybe also catching the unwary to learn something of their hidden art, but when none of these devices succeeded, he sought to sow evil desires and discords among the gnomes, telling them that lie concerning the council when the Eldar were first bidden to Valinor. Note 1. Slaves are ye, he would say, or children, an you will, bidden play with toys, and seek not to stray or know too much. Good days mayhap the Valar give you, as ye say. Seek but to cross their walls, and ye shall know the hardness of their hearts. Lo, they use your skill, and to your beauty they hold fast as an adornment of their realms. This is not love, but selfish desire. Make test of it. Ask for your inheritance that Ilúvatar designed for you, the whole wide world to roam, with all its mysteries to explore, and all its substances to be material of such mighty crafts as never can be realized in these narrow gardens, penned by the mountains, hemmed in by the impassable sea. Hearing these things, despite the true knowledge which Nolome had and spread abroad, there were many who hearkened with half their hearts to Melko, and restlessness grew amongst them, and Melko poured oil on their smouldering desires. From him they learnt many things it were not good for any but the great Valar to know, for being half comprehended such deep and hidden things slay happiness. And besides, many of the sayings of Melko were cunning lies, or were but partly true, and the Noldoli ceased to sing, and their viols fell silent upon the hills of Kor, for their hearts grew somewhat older, as their lore grew deeper, and their desires more swollen, and the books of their wisdom were multiplied as the leaves of the forest. For know that in those days Aule, aided by the gnomes, contrived alphabets and scripts, and on the walls of Kor were many dark tales written in pictured symbols, and runes of great beauty were drawn thereto, or carved upon stones. And Earendel read many a wondrous tale there long ago, and mayhap still is many a one still there to read, if it be not corrupted into dust. The other elves heeded these things not overmuch, and were at times sad and fearful at the lessened gladness of their kinsmen. Great mirth had Melko at this, and wrought in patience, biding his time, yet no nearer did he get to his end, for despite all his labours, the glory of the trees and the beauty of the gems, and the memory of the dark ways from Palasor held back the Noldali, and ever Nolame spake against Melko, calming their restlessness and discontents. At length so great became his care that he took counsel with Feanor, and even with Inwe and Ellu Melemno, who then led the Solus Impi, and took their rede that Manwe himself be told of the dark ways of Melko. And Melko, knowing this, was in great anger against the gnomes, and going first before Manwe, bowed very low, and said how the Noldali dared murmur to his ears against Manwe's lordship, claiming that in skill and beauty they, whom Ilúvatar had destined to possess all the earth, far surpassed the Valar, for whom they must labour unrecompensed. Heavy was Manwe's heart at these words, for he had feared long that that great amity of the Valar and Eldar be ever perchance broken, knowing that the elves were children of the world, and must one day return to her bosom. Nay, who shall say but that all these deeds, even the seeming needless evil of Melko, were but a portion of the destiny of old? Yet cold was the lord of the gods to the informer, and lo, even as he questioned him further, the embassy of Nolame came thither, and being granted leave, spake the truth before him. By reason of the presence of Melko, perchance, they spoke somewhat less skilfully in their own cause than they might, and perchance even the heart of Manwe Sulimo was tainted with the poison of Melko's words, for that venom of Melko's malice is very strong and subtle indeed. Howbeit, both Melko and the Noldali were chidden and dismissed. Melko indeed was bidden get him back to Mandos and there dwell a while in penitence, nor dare to walk in Valmar for many moons, not until the great festival that now approached had come and gone. But Manwe, fearing lest the pollution of their discontent spread among the other kindreds, commanded Aule to find other places, and thither lead the Noldali, and build them a new town where they might dwell. Great was the sorrow upon the hill of Kor when those tidings were brought thither, and though all were wroth with the treachery of Melko, yet was there now a new bitterness against the gods, and the murmuring louder than before. A little stream, and its name was Hiri, ran down from the hills northward of the opening to the coast where Kor was built, and it wandered thence across the plain, no one knew whither. Maybe it found the outer seas, for north of the roots of Silpion it dived into the earth, and there was a rugged place and a rock-ringed dale, and here the Noldali purposed to abide, or rather to await the passing of wrath from Manwe's heart, for in no way as yet would they accept the thought of leaving Kor forever. Caves they made in the walls of that dale, and thither they bore their wealth of gems, of gold and silver and fair things, but their ancient homes in Kor were empty of their voices, filled only with their paintings and their books of lore, and the streets of Kor and all the ways of Valmar shone still with gems and carven marbles, telling of the days of the happiness of the gnomes that cometh now upon its waning. Now Melko gets him gone to Mandos, and far from Valinor he plans rebellion and vengeance upon both gnomes and gods. Indeed, dwelling for nigh 3 ages in the vaults of Mandos, Melko had made friends to himself of certain gloomy spirits there, and perverted them to ill, promising them great lands and regions on the earth for their having, if they aided him when he called on them in need. And now he gathers them to him in the dark ravines of the mountains about Mandos. Thence sends he spies, invisible as fleeting shades when Silpion is in bloom, and learns of those doings of the Noldali and of all that passes in the plain. Now soon after it chanced indeed that the Valar and Eldar held a great feast, even that one that Manwe had spoken of, bidding Melko rid Valmar of his presence at that time. For know that they made merry on one day every seventh year to celebrate the coming of the Eldar into Valinor, and every third year a lesser feast to commemorate the coming of the white fleet of the Solus Impi to the shores of Eldamar. But at every 21st year, when both these feasts fell together, they held one of the greatest magnificence, and it endured for 7 days, and for this cause such years were called years of double mirth. Footnote, added in the margin here, Samirien. End of footnote. And these feasts, all the Koreldar, wherever they now may be in the wide world, still do celebrate. Now that feast that approacheth is one of double mirth, and all the hosts of the gods and elves made ready to celebrate it most gloriously. Pomps there were, and long processions of the elves, dancing and singing, that wound from Kor to Valmar's gates. A road had been laid against this festival from the westward gate of Kor, even to the turrets of the mighty arch, which opened in the walls of Valmar, northward towards the trees. Of white marble it was, and many a gentle stream flowing from the far mountains crossed its path. Here it would leap into slender bridges, marvellously fenced with delicate balustrades that shone like pearls. Scarcely did these clear the water, so that lilies of great beauty growing upon the bosom of the streams that fared but gently in the plain, thrust their wide blossoms about its borders, and iris marched along its flanks. For by cunning delving, runnels of clearest water were made to flow from stream to stream, bordering that whole long way with the cool noise of rippling water. At places mighty trees grew on either side, or at places the road would open to a glade, and fountains spring by magic high into the air for the refreshment of all who sped that way. Now came the Teleri, led by the white-robed people of the Inwir, and the throbbing of their congregated harps beat the air most sweetly. And after them went the Noldoli, mingling once more with their own dear folk by Manwe's clemency, that his festival might be duly kept, but the music that their viols and instruments awoke was now more sweetly sad than ever before. And last came the people of the shores, and their piping blent with voices brought the sense of tides and murmurous waves, and the wailing cry of the coast-loving birds thus inland deep upon the plain. Then was all that host marshalled before the gate of Valmar, and at the word and sign from Inwe as one voice they burst in unison into the song of light. This had Lirillo, note 2, written and taught them, and it told of the longing of the elves for light, of their dread journey through the dark world, led by the desire of the two trees, and sang of their utmost joy beholding the faces of the gods, and their renewed desire once more to enter Valmar, and tread the Valar's blessed courts. Then did the gates of Valmar open, and Nornore bid them enter, and all that bright company passed through. There Varda met them, standing amid the companies of the Manir and the Suruli, and all the gods made them welcome, and feasts there were in all the great halls thereafter. Now their custom was, on the third day, to robe themselves all in white and blue, and ascend to the heights of Taniquetil, and there would Manwe speak to them, as he thought fit, of the music of the Ainur and the glory of Ilúvatar, and of things to be and that had been. And on that day would Kor and Valmar be silent and still, but the roof of the world and the slope of Taniquetil shine with the gleaming raiment of the gods and elves, and all the mountains echo with their speech. But afterward, on the last day of merriment, the gods would come to Kor, and sit upon the slopes of its bright hill, gazing in love upon that slender tarn, and thereafter, blessing it in the name of Ilúvatar, would depart ere Silpion came to bloom. And so would end the days of double mirth. But in this fateful year, Melko dared of his blasphemous heart to choose that very day of Manwe's speech upon Taniquetil for the carrying out of his designs. For then would Kor and Valmar and the rock-ringed dale of Sir Numen be unguarded. For against whom, indeed, had Elf or Vala need to guard in those old days? creeping then down with his dark people on the third day of Samirian, as that feast was named, he passed the dark halls of Makar's abode, for even that wild Vala had gone to Valmar to honor the time, and indeed all of the gods went there, saving Fwy and Vefantur only. And Ossé even was there, dissembling for those 7 days his feud and jealousy with Ulmo. Here does a thought come to Melko's heart, and he arms himself and his band stealthily with swords, very sharp and cruel, and this was well for them, for now do they all steal into the vale of Sir Numen, where the Noldoli had their present dwelling, and behold, the gnomes, by reason of the workings in their hearts of Melko's own teaching, had become wary and suspicious beyond the wont of the Eldar of those days. Guards of some strength were set over the treasures there, that went not to the feast, albeit this was contrary to the customs and ordinances of the gods. Now is there suddenly bitter war awake in the heart of Valinor, and those guards are slain, even while the peace and gladness upon Tanaquitil afar is very great. Indeed, for that reason, none heard their cries. Now Melko knew that it was indeed war forever between himself and all those other folk of Valinor, for he had slain the Noldoli, guests of the Valar, before the doors of their own homes. With his own hand, indeed, he slew Brithwyr, father of Feanor, and bursting into that rocky house that he defended, laid hands upon those most glorious gems, even the Silmarils, shut in a casket of ivory. Now all that great treasury of gems he despoiled, and lading himself and all his companions to the utmost, he seeks how he may escape. Know then that Orome had great stables and a breeding ground of good horses not so far from this spot, where a wild forest land had grown up. Thither Melko steals, and a herd of black horses he captures, cowing them with the terror that he could wield. Astride those, his whole company of thieves rides far away after destroying what things of lesser value they deemed it impossible to carry thence. Making a wide circuit, and faring with the speed of hurricanes, such as only the divine horses of Orome, ridden by the children of the gods, could compass, they pass far to the west of Valmar, in the untracked regions, where the light of the trees was thin. Long ere the folk had come down from Tanaquitil, and long ere the end of the feast, or ever the Noldoli fared back, to find their homes despoiled, Melko and his thieves were ridden to the deep south. And finding there a low place in the hills, they passed into the plains of Eruman. Well might Arle and Tulkas bemoan their carelessness in leaving that low place long ago, when they reared those hills to fend all evil from the plain, for that was the place where they were accustomed to enter Valinor after their quarryings in the fields of Arvalin. Note 4. End of Side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 6, The Book of Lost Tales, Part 1, continuing with The Theft of Melko and the Darkening of Valinor, on page 145. It is said, indeed, that this riding in a half-circle, laborious and perilous as it was at first no part of Melko's design, for rather had he purposed to get to northward over the passes nigh to Mandos. But this, he was warned, might not be done, for Mandos and Fwy never left those realms, and all the ravines and chasms of the northward mountains were infested with their folk, nor for all his gloom was Mandos any rebel against Manwë, or an abettor of evil deeds. Far to the north, if one may endure the colds as Melko could, it is said in ancient lore that the great seas narrow to a little thing, and without aid of ships, Melko and his company might thus have got into the world safely. But this was not done, and the sad tale took its appointed course. All the two trees might yet have shone, and the elves sung still in Valinor. At length, that daytide of festival is over, and the gods are turned back towards Valmar, treading the white road from Kor. The lights twinkle in the city of the elves, and peace dwells there, but the Noldoli fare over the plain to Sir Numen sadly. Silpion is gleaming in that hour, And ere it wanes, the first lament for the dead that was heard in Valinor rises from that rocky vale, for Feanor laments the death of Bruithwyr. And many of the gnomes beside find that the spirits of their dead have winged their way to Ve. Then messengers ride hastily to Valmar, bearing tidings of the deeds, and there they find Manwë, for he has not yet left that town for his abode upon Taniquetil. "Alas, O Manwë Sulimo," they cry, "evil has pierced the mountains of Valinor, and fallen upon Sir Numen of the plain. There lies Bruithwyr, sire of Feanor, note 5, dead, and many of the Noldoli beside, and all our treasury of gems and fair things, and the loving travail of our hands and hearts through many years is stolen away. Whither, O Manwë, whose eyes see all things? Who has done this evil? For the Noldoli cry for vengeance, O most just one." Then said Manwë to them, "Behold, O children of the Noldoli, my heart is sad towards you, for the poison of Melko has already changed you, and covetous has entered your hearts. Lo, had ye not thought your gems and fabrics, note 6, of better worth than the festival of the folk or the ordinances of Manwë your lord, this had not been, and Bruithwyr Gormaidras and those other hapless ones still had lived, and your jewels been in no greater peril. Nay, my wisdom teaches me that because of the death of Bruithwyr and his comrades shall the greatest evils fall on gods and elves and men to be. Without the gods who brought you to the light and gave you all the materials of your craft, teaching your first ignorance, none of these fair things you love now so well ever would have been. What has been done may again be done, for the power of the Valar does not change, but of more worth than all the glory of Valinor and all the grace and beauty of Kor is peace and happiness and wisdom, and these, once lost, are harder to recapture. Cease then to murmur and to speak against the Valar, or to set yourselves in your hearts as equals to their majesty. Rather depart now in penitence, knowing full well that Melko has wrought this evil against you, and that your secret trafficking with him has brought you all this loss and sorrow. Trust him not again, therefore, nor any others that whisper secret words of discontent among you, for its fruit is humiliation and dismay." And the embassy was abashed and afraid, and went back unto Sir Numen, utterly cast down. Yet was Manwë's heart heavier than theirs, for things had gone ill indeed, and yet he foresaw that worse would be, and so did the destinies of the gods work out, for lo, to the Noldoli Manwë's words seemed cold and heartless, and they knew not his sorrow and his tenderness, and Manwë thought them strangely changed, and turned to covetous, who longed but for comfort, being like children, very full of the loss of their fair things. Now Melko findeth himself in the wastes of Arvalin, and knoweth not how he may escape, for the gloom there is very great, and he knoweth not those regions that stretch there unto the utmost south. Therefore he sent a messenger, claiming the inviolable right of a herald, albeit this was a renegade servant of Mandos, whom Melko had perverted, over the pass to Valinor, and there standing before the gates of Valmar, note 7, he demanded audience of the gods. And it was asked of him whence he came, and he said, "From Ainu Melko," and Tulkas would have hurled stones at him from the walls and slain him. But the others as yet suffered him not to be mishandled, but despite their anger and loathing, they admitted him to the great square of gold that was before Aule's courts. And at the same hour riders were sent to Kor and to Sir Numen, summoning the elves, for it was guessed that this matter touched them near. When all was made ready, the messenger took stand, beside the needle of pure gold, whereon Aule had written the story of the kindling of the tree of gold. In Lorien's courts stood one of silver with another tale, and on a sudden Manwë said, "Speak," and his